Welcome to Deacon Dialogues, bringing you a deacon's perspective on the world we live in and the Catholic faith we are called to. And now, here are your hosts, Deacon Rich Napoli and his wife, Janet.
Hello and welcome, everyone. Hi, this is Deacon Rich Napoli. I'm joined here by my beautiful wife, Janet.
Good morning, everyone. Oh, I have to say good afternoon. I'm good so afternoon, used to being on in the morning. Good afternoon, everyone. Oh, what a beautiful afternoon it is.
It is, and this is Deacon Dialogues. It's our monthly show to talk about matters of faith and family and the perspective of a deacon and his wife on those kinds of issues. Well, it's been, summer's over now, and fall is kicking into high gear here. We've got so many events, school events, and
conferences, and dinner parties, and
holidays, and lots of,
yeah,
year-end business planning. So it's the pace has definitely picked up over these past few weeks.
Near the end of September.
I know. It's almost time for Halloween. I know the Halloween decorations are starting to pop up in some places. I know, including ours.
All right. Well, the kids are coming home this weekend, so I wanted to have it done for them.
Right. we've done, 7 or 8 shows now as we've done this program. And, over the time, we've covered several different topics, theology of the body and hermeneutics, how to stay Catholic at college. But periodically, what we've wanted to also talk about is the sharing of one man's journey from, where he was to becoming a deacon. And you've, in the past, you've heard my story going from being an atheist to a deacon. And what we'd like to do now is introduce you to one of my classmates to share his remarkable journey from being an alcoholic to a recovering alcoholic and now to a deacon. And it's an incredible story. Deacon Dan Giblin is a deacon at St. Anne's Church in Phoenixville. He's actually a Phoenixville native, born and raised, and went to St. Pius High School, pursued a career first in photography, and then later joined IBM. I'm actually going to talk to you about that because as a computer guy myself, it's something I'm interested in. But first of all, welcome, Dan, and we look forward to talking with you.
Well, thanks, Rich.
Hi,
Janet.
Dan.
It's great to see you guys. I haven't seen you in this kind of setting for a while, so I miss seeing you.
Yeah, right. We spent 6 years in classrooms together at the seminary.
Weekly,
and on weekends, and it was quite a journey.
Treats.
Mm-hmm. Quite a journey. And that's one of the things I think that I'm always amazed at when I look back is, there were 19 of us in our class, as you know, and there are certain parts of our journeys that are all very similar. We all seem to have, that notion of feeling called, of maybe somebody suggesting that we do things, and then obviously we have this shared formation story. But yet, as you talk to each person's story of how they got there, how they received the call, what their life was like before, what their life changed to as they became a deacon, they're all fascinating stories, and there's 19 different stories there, and I think over the coming years we'll get to all of them. But today we wanted to talk to you about your story, Dan, and I know...
And I want to mention, Dan, when we were thinking about who to have as our first guest, I have to say you came to mind for both of us first.
Oh.
And I just wanted to say it's because I remember first meeting you in class.
Yeah.
And there's just such a warmth about you. There's an honesty. You're approachable. You're relatable. And there's just something very special about you. And I know that you, as a deacon, you bring those qualities, those gifts that God has given you into your work. And it's really a blessing to know you, to have been on that journey with you, and to now have you and share you with the Holy Spirit Radio family.
Oh, that's very, very kind. Right back at you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely you're, I always hold you up as sort of the quintessential deacon, just somebody that anybody feels comfortable turning to, and always with a smile. Thankfully, with your technical software background, always with all kinds of technical help, you put up websites for us. And
his great ability with photography, where you took our yearly shots and really categorized all our events with pictures.
Yeah. We have lovely pictures of all those years, and you even brought your camera today. So I'm sure
I did.
We'll be doing more of that. But let's just start at the beginning. It's always good to get the background of the person a little bit as to the basics first. Where were you born, and about your schooling and your parents and your family and things like that.
Sure. Well, first of all, it is great to be here, and thanks again for inviting me. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be able to be here and share with folks. I was born and raised in Phoenixville, which is, for those who don't know, a little town in Chester County. When I grew up, it was a steel town, blue-collar town. My parents were immigrants came over from Ireland after the war. Mm-hmm. They came over, they knew each other in England, dated in England, and came over separately after the war, and got married in Phoenixville. And settled down, and had two children. I have one brother who's 2 years older than myself. He just finished up a career with the FBI, and then he did a couple years with NATO, and then a couple years with the Irish police. Between priests and cops in Irish families are very common. So we've got all the bases covered there. But I remember my mother really wanted, when she was picking out a house, to because we lived on this little small dingy street when I was born, and she used to come to this park area in Phoenixville that was about a block away from a Catholic church and a Catholic school, and she would sit in the park and she would tell me, she'd sit there and pray that, you know, please God, that I be able to get a house so that my kids could go to Mass and go to this Catholic school.
Mm. A beautiful prayer.
Lo and behold, a house became available one block away from the church, and that's where, for most of my years, I was raised, one block from the church and from the school. So I had 8 years of education in St. Anne's Parish School, and it was there that, like many boys...
So this is the parish you were serving as, the parish you grew up in?
Yes. So I'm serving in the parish that I was born and baptized in, that I was married in, and someday probably will be buried
from. They saw the good, the bad, the ugly, and the magnificent.
And they kept me anyway.
You know, I do want to remind people, I forgot to mention at the beginning of the show, this is a live show with a call-in, so if you do have questions for Deacon Dan or Janet or myself, please call us at 215-345-1570. That's 215-345-1570. So go ahead, Dan. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Like most kids at my time, I know your story is a little bit different, where you didn't have the opportunity to be an altar boy.
Not the desire.
Oh, really? I wanted to give you the benefit of the doubt there.
You did go to Catholic school.
I did go to Catholic school, but, you know, sort of by a twisted arm. That's about
right. Well, there was this attraction to me. Well, my brother was an altar boy, so some of it was I wanted to do what he had done. And luckily, when it was my turn in fifth grade, and at that time the Mass was still in Latin, so this was in the midst of Vatican II, so it was not trivial to become an altar boy. It's not today, like today, you just learn the choreography, put it on an alb, and you're an altar server. We had to memorize all the Latin, and it was much more rigid as far as the rubrics of the Mass and what we had to do, but I just wanted to do it. And I remember literally being in my bed at night with a flashlight under the covers, memorizing the Latin, because it was like such a big deal to be able to memorize this Latin and to interact with the priest on the altar that I had been just watching for years. So I became an altar boy, and I had a great priest who's, I believe, retired now, Father Paul Weedman, and that was his first assignment out of the seminary. And he was just perfect. He taught us by the book, but he was very gentle, and he just, without saying it, he instilled this attraction to this life, attraction to the life of being a priest. And that stuck. That stuck over the years. No matter what happened, it stuck. And as I was telling you right before the show started, this kind of continued on for years. And when I was in seventh grade, we got the opportunity to go on a vocation retreat to a monastery in New York, in Garrison, New York, the Friars of the Atonement. The mountain is called Graymore. And the priest had been born and raised in our parish and had been ordained a priest of that order. So he came back and took a busload of us up to Graymore on this weekend. And I went there, and I can't tell you one thing that was said or done over the weekend, but there was something established in me again that desire to be a priest, to be part of this. Maybe it was the brown robes and all the icons and just being in a monastery, but that always works. But that desire again kind of increased. And one of the ministries of that order, one of the local ministries of it, is working with alcoholics, because I guess the road that it's on is Route 9, which really is just an extension of Broadway.
Right.
So I guess
the
journeymen, or the hobos, as they used to call them, those that were homeward bound, frequently traversed Route 9, either in or out of New York, when they were down on their luck. And they started staying on the grounds of the mountain in this paint shack when the order was first established. And the founder of the order, you know, welcomed them and continued to, you know, increase the size of the paint shack for them. And that eventually grew into a full-out
Amazing.
Ministry for alcoholics. It was completely free. Any man could come and stay there for a month till he got his act together and got sober, but with the help of the Friars of the Atonement. So I came home, and
you
I remember...
You were just a boy then going... you were what, 10?
I was 7th grade.
7th grade, all right.
When I first experienced that. So I had no idea what all this was, you know, what alcoholics were, what...
Because you had nobody in your family or any issues like that going on. Okay.
No, I'd never seen it up front. The closest experience I had was when we'd go to the city, we'd take the Reading Railroad down and get off at Reading Terminal. And Reading Terminal was always kind of a waiting place for a lot of the guys that were coming off of Ray Street and Skid Row. And St. John's Hospice, that area was had a lot of alcoholics down on their luck, and that was my only experience with actually seeing them. So I had no idea what this attraction was to, I want to do this with my life. But I did come back and tell my mom. Yeah, I said, Mom, you know, I think I want to be a priest. And I think I want to work with alcoholics.
Wow. Careful what you pray for.
That's right, exactly. It was like, watch what you pray for because you might get it. And I did get it, but God's plan was to put me through one heck of an on-the-job training course before I would actually be working with them. As I went on to St. Pius X High School after grade school, and the world kind of takes over when we enter adolescence, and even if you hear this call and feel this call, it's always competing with whatever the culture is at the moment.
Certainly.
And this was the culture of the late 60s and early 70s, and it was unique, and it was certainly countercultural, and it was pulling away from the church, and it won. It won. That call was, I ignored that call, I ignored any sign of it, and I went on with what the world was leading me to, which at the time was to be, to pursue a career in photography. So I went through art school for 3 years down in Philadelphia, and started a career as a photographer. And at some point I actually had my first drink, which is obviously required if you're going to be an alcoholic. And, I should have known from the first time.
How old was that?
I was probably around 18.
Okay.
I mean, it was fairly late considering what a lot of kids do today. But I should have known because the first time I picked up a drink, I got drunk.
Really?
Which not everybody does. Mm. And I experienced a blackout.
Wow.
Which is I lost a part of the evening before, had no memory of it, no recollection of it, but I continued to function, interact with people, to speak with people, and I had no recollection of it
the
next day. And the clincher was when I was asked about it the day after, I lied to my parents. There was no reason to lie,
right?
But there was just something in me told me that I have to hide this. Whatever happened was not right. I had to hide it. So
somewhere you knew you shouldn't be proud of this.
Right. And I mean, a lot of kids go through it and they just said, wow, you wouldn't believe what happened. I got drunk. But I knew there was something wrong there. I knew, and I knew it was like the answer to everything. Like every bad feeling was taken away, after a couple of drinks. But then there was no stopping point. And it ended in darkness, in literal darkness of having a blackout and in spiritual darkness. And then from that point, it's just a progression. It's, from that drink, things just get worse. As we were talking about before, the one clear indicator, and this is all my, experience and opinion. I'm not an authority. I'm not a certified counselor. It's just as an individual that's lived a life and has worked with others for 28 years now. You can never portray an alcoholic and say, this is the exact picture, this is the definition, this is the litmus test. If they get fired or this happens, that makes them. There is no definition of it. And what it is for every individual, that's what it is. So Father Martin, who I'll come to a little bit later, always said, if you find somebody with problems in their lives, if you find a dysfunctional family or a person, and alcohol is part of the picture, the first thing you do is remove the alcohol, and everything else will get better. It won't be cured, but it will get better. And that's the only common denominator, that the drug is there, the substance is there, and that over time things get progressively worse.
Let me just interrupt you there just to remind everyone that you're listening to WISP 1570 and WCLJ 1420 AM. This is Holy Spirit Radio, and you're listening to Deacon Dialogues. I'm your host, Rich Napoli, Deacon Rich Napoli, with my wife, Janet, And we have as our guest my fellow classmate, Deacon Dan Giblin, who's sharing his faith journey from some pretty dark times there as being an alcoholic all the way back to being an ordained deacon. So you talk about being in this darkness. What was your faith life like during that time? Because you had this early calling, and that's been kind of pushed aside. Was your faith active during all this darkness?
No, it came to an abrupt end, I'd say, in high school. Because even though I was going to Catholic high school, it was still this period of the late 60s, early 70s, when the church was still redefining itself in some respect.
And, so you weren't going to church?
Not unless I was made to.
No.
So I would go when I was in...
I'd say, you go, parents. You make your kids go.
And they could get away with that for a while. Right. But at about 16, it stopped working. Mm. And I was surrounded with it in school. Right. Obviously, it's a Catholic school. But you can be surrounded by something and not absorb anything. And that's what the reality was. I was more interested in everything that wasn't part of that culture.
Did you like the way the alcohol made you feel? Like, were you a quiet, shy person, and then did the alcohol make you more, social in a way that, was attractive?
It is the magic elixir of whatever your shortcoming or your fear is, it will address.
Okay.
So, yes, and I do fit in that I'm old of I was be a little shy and have a few drinks, and it's a depressant, it's an anesthesia. It relieves all inhibitions. Mm. And the old beer courage, as it's called, of suddenly, you have no fears. You have no fears of interacting. You have no fears of anything, really. The problem was it couldn't stop at a couple of drinks when that feeling was acquired, and it would just keep going until, again, complete darkness had happened. But again, it's progressive over time. So I stopped going to church, and certainly as soon as I got out of St. Pius, I was inactive in the church. So I just did not go on Sundays. Absolutely, I couldn't relate to it. I had nothing against it. I remember actually being in barroom discussions with people, and I would defend the church and defend the faith and their need to practice it, and I wasn't practicing it myself. Mm. So it was very confusing in that here's somebody who I had this belief. But I wasn't doing it, so there was always that contradiction there. I eventually got out of school. I got a career in photography, and I'll save you all the drunk logs, as they're sometimes called, through where it took me. I mean, thank God I never had horrendous things happen to me externally. I was never arrested. I was never in a car accident. I never hurt anybody else. Things
you didn't
like
have
that.
A wife and children to think of.
Exactly.
So the responsibility was for yourself.
Relationships were just not on the horizon at all for me with the life I was leading.
It would be difficult to have one, too, with that kind of...
Oh, yeah. It would. And they say, disease, alcoholism especially, is a disease of isolation. It's a disease of loneliness. Mm-hmm. And it can be isolation and loneliness if you have a huge family and you can still be isolated and lonely. And it very much is. It was a very progressive move away from people physically, socially, and certainly spiritually. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when you look at society of like when we want to take somebody and inflict the worst punishment we do to them, what do?
Isolation.
Solitary confinement. Mm. We put them by themselves. And yet if you look at people that are in addiction, that's exactly the result
themselves.
And not by design. It's not like somebody says, I want to lose my job, lose my family, and be by myself. This is all just a result of this need that they see, this absolute need that they are powerless over.
And is there any kind of logical thinking going on that this could happen if I continue on this path of destruction? I could lose everything? Or it's like, well, that's not going to happen to me.
Don't
even think about it.
Both. I think both trains of thought are there of it will never happen. And there was also a thought of something bad is going to happen someday. Mm-hmm. I do recall that being in a period of unemployment and just, nothing to do all day but drink and think something big is going to happen and change things. It will either be I die or something big.
Some major,
and again, I was wrong. when help came in, it came in very quietly, in a whisper, and in a way that I never would have planned.
Let's talk about that a bit. So you're in this darkness. You're really not that active in your faith at that point. You haven't
at all,
right? For some, the road back, has a sudden jolt to get you going. And it sounds like in your case it was something more subtle than that.
Well, in reality, you did lose everything, though, right?
I was going to say,
yes.
In some ways.
So you really have to kind of hit bottom at some point. So maybe go into
yeah.
that.
Yeah, everybody's got you know, a bottom. It doesn't necessarily have to be the dramatic life event. And for me, it was progressive, and it was over time of slowly losing job, friends, you know, a place to live, things like that. But since it happened slowly, it's like you just start to accept. You start
right.
to accept the
you
fact.
You adjust to it.
Yes.
Slowly.
If I'm going to have this in my life and I can't live without that, then I will take all these byproducts.
Mm-hmm.
And I did hit little bottoms along the way that – and when I did, I remember one when clearly I was living in Bent Salem at the time and was out of work. Had some kind of bottom. Something happened that just kind of smacked me upside the head.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a Saturday afternoon, and I drove around and drove into a church because I knew there'd be confessions on Saturday afternoon. And it was just like I couldn't stop myself. I went into the church, went into the confessional, knelt down, and just let it all out.
Wow.
And in hindsight, I should have waited because there wasn't a priest in the confessional yet. And I had a great rehearsal for what I was going to say to him when he got there 5 minutes later, because
oh, no.
I didn't quite have the schedule of when confessions were down, Pat. But I just let it all out. He came. Eventually, he did show up, and it all came out.
Mm.
All this darkness, all these secrets, all this thing I've been hiding, this was my life, it all came out. And there was relief for a bit, but you know, I didn't follow up with what I should have done next.
Sure.
And it continued on for a few more years.
Because the alcohol's calling you still.
Exactly.
It's very seductive, I'm sure, and just keeps like, calling you back.
And it's funny, yeah, the thing that it you know, a lot of times with people that struggle with addictions, it's the thing that they're most looking for that draws them to that addiction is the one thing they'll never get. So in your case, you know, it's to make you more social and gregarious, and what does it do? It actually isolates you further than ever. And I'm always fascinated by how addictions never give you the one thing that you are hoping that you're going to get from it.
Exactly. Or if you have your first drink and you think, oh, I've never had this feeling before, then the person spends the rest of their life trying to replicate that, and they never get that back again.
Right.
They never get that first experience back again, and the life goes downhill, you know, with it.
Right.
It's the God-shaped hole that everybody seems to have that we try to fill. For the alcoholic, we try to fill it with alcohol, and it's an addictive substance, and it acts on a spiritual, mental, and a physical level. But the word addictions today can just mean just about anything.
Yeah,
it's
sort
of used a little too loosely.
Right.
But in the same regard, it's also, I think, to fill some God-shaped hole, some hole in the soul that's not being filled. We try to fill it with money or prestige, with substances, with sex, with something it tries to get filled with. The common denominator is the answer to these things is always it's a spiritual answer. It is a God-shaped hole. So the only thing that's going to fill it is your relationship with God.
Right.
You know, and not everybody gets to find that out because unfortunately not everybody gets the gift of sobriety and life. And I've been to countless funerals over my time in sobriety of people who didn't make it. And I don't know why. It's not that I knew something they didn't know. It's not a matter of intelligence. Actually, they say the three biggest handicaps of somebody getting sober are brains, education, and money.
Really?
Wow.
I'm sorry. Youth, education, and money.
Okay.
So if you're young enough, you think, I'll live through it. I'll get by it.
Sure.
If I have of education or brains, you think, I'm smarter than this. I can get out of this situation. And if you have money, you can buy your way out of anything. So sometimes it's not until all those things are gone, because certainly your money will go away and your youth will go away and the substance will take whatever intelligence you have, you know, and certainly diminish that. But those are barriers to somebody admitting that, yes, I have a problem. But those were things that at that point I didn't know, and quite frankly, I wasn't that smart, and I wasn't getting any younger, and I didn't have any money. So
now you're broke. You're You have nothing. What do you do?
You living back with your parents?
I was forced back into the parental home. And
how old are you at this point?
29. So I said I missed most of my 20s. And people will always say, well, I did this in my 20s and I did that in my 20s. I have no recollection of what I did in my 20s.
So you're actually 10 years younger than you think, right?
I am. I try to act that way. My mother, who was just passed away 4 months ago, she, a good Irish Catholic mother, when she didn't know what to do, she turned to the church. And she offered me an ultimatum. She said, you either have to go talk to the priest or get out.
I love that.
Get out. Yeah, oh, those are your choices.
That's a mom.
Yep. And so I made an appointment with the priest. And as I was walking up the steps of the rectory, I still didn't know what I was going to tell him because the alcohol can be very manipulative. Mm. I was all prepared to go in there and say.
Did you drink before you went to see him?
No.
Okay, I was just curious.
No, no. If I did, I had enough breath mints, so he wouldn't he wouldn't know. But I was all set to go in and say, "Well, look, Father, I've lost my job, I've lost my apartment, I'm really down on my luck. I've never had a girlfriend, all this kind of stuff. You know, you would drink too if you had this life, wouldn't you?" Or I was just going to, say, "I have a problem, and I need help." And I just read on somewhere the three hardest things to say are, "I need help," "I'm sorry," and "I love you." Mm. And I couldn't say that first one, which was, "I need help."
Right.
Mm. But I sat down in front of him, and he said, "Why are you here?" And I was given the grace of that moment and said, "Father, I think I'm an alcoholic."
Wow.
And I thought it was going to be very dramatic, and bells and whistles would go off, and the music would play. And he was very nonchalant. He was a young man, probably in his 30s at that time. He said, "Okay," he said, "what do you want to do about it?" And I said, "I don't want to do anything about it. I'm just here because I have to be here.
Get a drink."
Right. <Yeah. laughs> "Get a few and we'll talk it over." And he said, "Well, my father's an alcoholic. He went to a rehab and he's sober today."
Mm.
He said, "What I want you to do is, here's the names of two rehabs. Go home, make some calls, pick out one to go to, and I'll bring you down there."
I'll bring you down. I like that.
Yeah. He picked me up, brought me down. But he gave me the task of making all the arrangements,
right.
And I did. And the place that I picked was Father Martin's Ashley, which is in Havre de Grace, Maryland. They were an advertiser in a Catholic Standard for years and years and years. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Very big today.
Yeah. What's the name again?
Father Martin's Ashley. Father Joseph Martin was the name. He was a Sulpician priest who their focus of the order is the education of other priests. And so he was trained. He was ordained. He was teaching in seminaries, had his own drinking problem, was kicked out of the seminaries, was almost kicked out of the order. And he got sober at a facility called Guest House, which is a rehab strictly for clergy. Okay. And he came back and he just... he wanted to establish a type of facility for everyone. Along the way, he became a fairly well-known speaker in the field of alcoholism. He has a very famous film called Chalk Talk, which just kind of explains alcoholism to everybody and makes it very, it's a very plain down-to-earth explanation of what goes on and why the body reacts this way. And the person has an allergy to substance alcohol, and you drink that way because that's the only way you can drink. Mm. That's the way your body processes the chemical. It's like you drink coffee, and nobody picks up a cup of coffee their first time, black coffee, and says, "This is delicious." You have to add sugar to it. You have to add cream. You have to learn to drink this substance that has an effect on you, that speeds you up. And it's the same with alcohol. We have to get this liquid
and
make it sweet and put cherries in it and do all this thing to learn how to drink the substance that has an effect on us. So it was a very definite process, and he was an excellent communicator, very well known in the field. I knew nothing about him at that point, but I was dropped off there on January 12th of 1984, and not a lot of recollection of the ride down with the priest who took me down, but he told me.
What was your state before you?
We were talking before. I figured, as every good alky does, wants to try and squeeze in one last drink. And at that point, one last drink for me was a quart of Four Roses.
That's a whiskey?
That's whiskey. Yeah. Okay. So I got up a little early, about 4 in the morning, started chugging that one.
Wow.
And was ready for my ride down by 8 o'clock. He came off of 8 o'clock mass and picked me up. need to tell me later I never shut up the whole ride down. So I guess it did have its effect on me. And I was also petrified because I had the thought of at the end of this ride, there's going to be a change. And the change is going to be this substance is never going to be part of my life again, or at least for the next month. But I walked into that place thinking, I can't live without this substance. And by that evening, when I was surrounded by other people with the same condition, same disease, I wanted what they had, which was, you know, a week, a month of sobriety, a year of sobriety, because then I knew that it was possible. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, I thought, I can't ever live in any other way. And that place, that night, gave me hope that, I am not hopeless. Nobody's hopeless. And I can have what they have. And that was the start of everything for me. Luckily, being having the facility's leader be a priest, he would have mass every Sunday, even though they didn't have a chapel at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was that mass, that first mass, which was just 3 days after I was dropped off there, is still one of the most remarkable ones of my life. So I hadn't been in a church in years. Certainly hadn't received the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. And it was always from a feeling of, I'm not worthy. How could I even set foot in a church living this life? And what came to life to me was the prodigal son of there was a father in mass and the Eucharist extended to me and there was no questions asked. There was no guilt. There was no finger pointing. There was just welcome home.
Let's just remind everyone you're listening to WISP at 1570 AM and 1420 AM. This is Holy Spirit Radio. You're here on Deacon Dialogues with I'm your host, Deacon Rich Napoli, here with my beautiful wife, Janet. And we're have as our guest today Deacon Dan Giblin, one of my classmates in the diaconate program. And he's sharing his faith journey of how he went from being an active alcoholic. As you say, you never fully recovered, so you're still a recovering alcoholic. But actually all the way through that to becoming a deacon. If you do have questions for Deacon Dan or myself or Janet, please give us a call at 215-345-1570. That's 215-345-1570. Maybe you are struggling yourselves with an alcohol problem, or maybe someone in your family is, and maybe you have some questions for Deacon Dan. I'm sure he'd be happy to answer them for you. Sure. So let's get back. So you've had this beginning, sort of a turning around of you actually see people that have been where you are and are somewhere better than you are, and now you're trying to get there yourself. So you're at this place for about a month, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
28 days, and I loved it so much I didn't want to leave.
Not bad.
I even got the insurance to let me stay 2 extra days because I could have stayed there for the rest of my life I enjoyed it, but I couldn't see. I thought if I leave there,
the safety net
is waiting for me, and I just can't do it out there. But thank goodness they did. They also kicked me out after 28 days.
Do they empower you with tools, or like what do they give you to say, okay, now go into the world?
They do. I mean, this was in the days when these rehabs were still fairly new. I mean, Betty Ford was just coming into the news as a big facility, but that was for the rich and famous. And it seems like today every you know, Tom and Dick and Harry goes to a rehab for something, but in those days they were fairly rare, and some of their programs were still in their infancy. Father Martin's was very simple. You know, it was to focus on the definition of what your issue is, what the answer is. The answer will be spiritual. The answer will be in 12-step recovery of movement, and that's it. That's all we have to give you besides this time away from your life. So they separated me from my life, separated me from alcohol, informed me enough of what I had to do when I left there to carry on. So there is no magic answer. It's like practicing our faith. It is practice. It's a daily, I won't say struggle because it's not a struggle anymore, but it's a daily task.
I'm sure every day.
Certainly. Yeah. And you never get away from the awareness of it.
You mentioned the 12-step program, and I hear that term all the time, but maybe you could just spend a minute just describing what that is. I mean, because I hear it applied, obviously, to alcoholics, but applied to other addictions as well. What is it about that, you know, what is that process and how does it work?
It must be successful if it be around all these years.
Yeah, and it's just exploded for every other issue and addiction around. There's everything anonymous, and you just put anything in front of anonymous, and it works. And the 12 steps grew out of the struggles of really two gentlemen that started the whole recovery movement, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, and they had the very beginnings of sobriety based on a spiritual experience, and primarily Bill Wilson, he was had a couple of months of sobriety and had this spiritual, you know, foundation that he knew he had to maintain if he was going to stay sober, and he was on a business trip to Akron, Ohio. And he wanted to drink. He wanted to drink like nobody's business. But he knew he couldn't. And there's a famous scene in one of the movies they've made of his life where he comes down in a lobby and the bar is on one side and there's a bank of telephones on the other side. And he turns and goes towards the telephones, looks at the church directory, and starts calling churches that are in the area. But he wasn't calling churches to get, you know, consolation or comfort or advice from the ministers. What he was calling for was to ask the ministers, do you know any alcoholics? Because I'm an alcoholic and I need to find one to help. Mm-hmm. Because at that point it had been clear to him that the the only way that he could maintain his sobriety was by trying to pass it on to someone else. So the big bang moment of the whole recovery movement was when he called his ministers and says, do you know an alcoholic? I could help. And eventually he found one. It was a Dr. Bob Smith was his name, was a proctologist, ironically enough. There was many jokes about that in the movement. And he caught him on a day when he'd just come off a bender, and this doctor did not want to see Bill Wilson at all. He said, I'll give you 5 minutes. When he showed up at his house the next day, Bill Wilson went in and they spoke for 5 hours.
Wow.
Because they sat down, and again, it was the same kind of experience that I had in rehab. If all of a sudden you're sitting down with somebody who's exactly the same as you, who's had exact same problems, exact same struggles, and they could relate. And they did, and that was really the foundation of it. And out of that grew the 12 steps, which are sometimes compared to the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. And it is a spiritual program, which the whole 12-step movements are kind of caricatured nowadays in, like, Saturday Night Live and things
like that.
Yeah, I
know, right.
Seinfeld.
Quickly, can you tell us about
Sure. The real easy way to summarize them into three steps is trust God, clean house, help others. So the first three steps are really just admitting a powerlessness over this, whatever your addiction is, for mine, for alcohol. Because even the terminology we use when we're describing somebody, we'll say, well, they're struggling with alcohol, or they're struggling with this, or and at some point you have to realize you can't struggle. You're never going to win.
Right.
You're never going to win. And the only way we win is by surrendering. You know, and as St. Paul says, it's in my, weakness that I'm strong. Right. And once we realize that, once we give in, then there's a chance for the power to come in. So there's that first realization of powerlessness and that your life's a mess, the identification of some higher power in your life.
Right.
It's a very broad definition, because, again, we need to meet people where they are.
Right.
And for some, that runs the gamut of what their experience may be, what they're open to. For a lot of people, it never comes down to the traditional understanding of God as we understand him.
Okay.
So they use the terminology in the steps of God as we understand them. For everybody, it can be different.
Sure.
But certainly the reliance on somebody outside, somebody greater than myself. For some people, even for atheists that have a problem, that when they come in, there's just the group becomes the higher power, because it's 6 or 8 or 10 or 20 people, they can do something that I can't do on my own.
Right.
So even from the very start, it's an identification, it's a relationship with God.
Yeah.
And then similar, they very did much borrow from I think our faith quite a bit. They borrowed confession, because those two of the steps are taking
step,
an inventory,
and
then admitting it to somebody else.
Okay.
Externalizing those faults. First identifying them, defining confronting the problem, just like a personal examination of conscience, and then not just saying in my head, well, I'll tell this to God, and I know he forgives me, but we know that doesn't work.
Right.
So the step says, if we admit these to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. So we have to externalize them. We have to verbalize them.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay, you know, I use that when I preach on the power of confession, and I use the analogy of, you know, that, you know, though the sacrament of confession, you know, you are talking to God through through a priest, there is something, just like for the alcoholic, until the words pass the threshold of your lips and are heard by another person, you can be in all kinds of denial or belief that God has healed you, but the physical act of saying the words and having someone there listening changes it, because now you can no longer, you know, say, you can no longer deny that you spoke those words, and it's now a revealed truth.
Revealed
truth. And the power in confession is, that is a part of your own recovery from your own sinful behavior, whatever the sins are. And, you know, the fact, you're right, the Alcoholic Anonymous movements, or those kinds of movements, 12-step movements, have taken that and adapted it for the same purpose.
And then I would think if we follow this even further, that maybe some kind of reparation would be made.
And there are, those are the steps that come after that, as you make amends to everybody that you need to make amends to. And it goes beyond the caricature of just saying, I'm going to go meet everybody I've ever seen and say, I'm sorry.
Right.
The word is amends. And so the imagery is that I'm mending. I'm mending the relationship. So my relationship with, say, my parents started in 84 and continued until my mom's death 4 months ago, and my dad is still alive, thank God, at 92. So that relationship continues to be mended into something that it never was before. So some amends are ongoing. But we do have that duty to make right the wrongs that we have done and to try and help the people that we may have harmed along the way.
How joyful they must have been when you came home from this 30 days away, or 32 if you conned an extra two days out of your insurance company, and to come back into the home and to embrace your parents as a sober individual, as their son. So what was that?
They were thrilled. They were thrilled. I did keep, my mother wrote letters to me when I was in rehab, and it was the days before email and all that kind of stuff, and so she would write every couple of days, and I still reread those letters every January on the anniversary of my sobriety, and the tone in the first letters are just still absolutely petrified what's going to happen. And then they bring the parents or family down for a meeting at the rehab, and after that, the tone completely changed, because Father Martin said to her and to the rest of the family, it's not your fault, you know, that they're an alcoholic. It's not their fault. They were born that way. It's their fault for whatever they've done. But she always had the Irish guilt of, what did I do to this kid? You know, I dropped on his head. Did I do this? That's right. It was a short drive for me. But she was very much relieved. And by the end of it, she was just thrilled. So she was always thrilled after that point. Could do no wrong as far as that goes. I had a regular life then and progressed along. You know, then life came. It was a level playing field then. I was with everybody else, you know, as far as career. And family and things like that. And I switched careers after a while and got into computer technology, all due to somebody in the recovery movement. It was the gentleman that was serving as my sponsor and spiritual guide, owned his own consulting firm, and said, you don't know anything about computers. I mean, I couldn't spell PC at the time. And he said, but I'll give you a job. And like within the next week, I was
great
on
job to go into great business.
That's right. Well, knowing nothing about it, but I was in Wall Street, Morgan Bank, sitting in meetings with all these execs, and I mean, I was so over my head. But it was a great way to learn in retrospect of always being in over your head. And I changed careers. I eventually did meet someone, a lovely young woman, and got married. I guess it's 18 years ago that we were married. And we have a daughter now, 16 years of age, wonderful daughter, Claire. She is a student, a junior at Pope John Paul.
You know, you mentioned, I just want to go back, as a fellow computer guy, I just got to say, I was looking over your bio. You were at the Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights? Wow. Now, for those of you that don't know, I mean, that is probably the most prestigious research center on the planet, you know, for not just applied research, but pure research about, you know, different topics and around relating to technology. And, you know, if you got to go there, that says an awful lot about, you know, how far, at least on a business side, how you came from not knowing anything to be invited to be at that research center, mm-hmm. and actually I think you published a book as well.
Yeah, it was mm-hmm. thrilling to be there because we actually worked in the same conference room, the same groups as the group that designed the computer that played against Garry Kasparov. Remember years ago, the chess game.
Chess game.
So all those trophies that they won were lining the walls, always intimidating us while we were working, of trying to come up with something just as good. But yeah, I did get to work up there for a couple of years,
and
at that point I was very focused on my career and. And they urged us to publish, and so I happened to get a book together with my boss at the time. And so they were great days, but again, it was focused on business.
Sure. There's a time you had some catching up to do. I mean, you lost a whole decade there.
Right.
So it sounds like you made some real progress there.
Yeah.
Let me just remind folks again that you're listening to Holy Spirit Radio on 1570 and 1420 AM. I'm your host, Deacon Rich Napoli, here with my wife, Janet, on Deacon Dialogues. And we have as our guest my classmate, Deacon Dan Giblin, who lives in Phoenixville, is a deacon at St. Anne's Parish, and he's recounting his story, his faith journey from some pretty dark days of alcoholism to how did you actually turn to becoming a deacon? But if you do have questions for Deacon Dan or for myself or Janet, please give us a call at 215-345-1570. That's 215-345-1570. So Dan, so let's fast forward a little bit now. So you're, you know, by all accounts now you're married. Your job is.
Was it an easy transition? I have to ask this though. You had to have some tough times.
Without a doubt.
Because I don't want to make it sound like it's too easy. You go to rehab for 30 days, then you come home and okay, everything's rosy. We're going to church, and I meet my perfect. You know, wife, and now I have a child. Yeah. I mean, like, there has to be...
Yeah, and I don't mean to gloss over that. There is real work that needs to be done. There are changes. I say you only have to change one thing, and that's everything. And it pretty much comes down to it. Because you change the way you think, the way you react, the way you... It's almost your instinct is to do left, do right when you first... Because your instincts are... really self-destructive for any alcohol, any addict. Their instinct is really one of self-destruction. And it does take some time until that instinct changes to one of existence instead of self-destruction. So, yeah, there were difficult days. There were struggles along the way. There were things I needed to learn that people learned back in their 20s. Because people that are in addictions, usually the maturation process stops. So whatever point you get sober is probably what, you know, the emotional
level.
Age
okay.
exactly when you started. So I was like, an 18-year-old in a 30-year-old's body. That's the way I reacted. That's the way I thought. But it's manageable. Those are sober problems. Those are living problems, which are quite different than drinking problems, which you're hopeless when you're in the addiction. But living problems, everybody has them.
Right.
You know, and
it's
we can all get through them.
Every day of the rest of our lives, we're going to have problems.
Right. And the cliche that's often used is one day at a time is how we do it. Is you do what you do today and get through the day.
I think that's a great way to live one day at a time because none of us know what. It's going to be around the corner.
Oh, sure.
And many of us deal with whether it's health issues or issues with family members and financial issues, whatever. And I think if we live in the moment, then we have that real gift of the presence as opposed to just always anticipating what might be.
Sure. Yeah.
Actually, we have a caller.
Oh.
We're going to put our headphones on here. Give us a second. We have Margie from Chester County. Hi, Margie.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, good. This is Deacon Rich here, and you have a question for Dan about marijuana use and its comparison, I guess, to alcohol. Is that right?
Yeah, popular these days, unfortunately, and I have a son who was an altar boy forever. I'm a Byzantine Catholic, and he chanted the epistle on Sundays and everything, and once he got to junior year of high school, suddenly everything kind of went down the tubes. I pray for him constantly. He tells me, he has voiced to me, he says, Mama, I smoke marijuana. I don't know how to stop. But he doesn't want me to help him. And he's 19. I don't know what
now.
To do. I just keep praying for him.
Well,
and I just try to teach him and show him that I love him. And I keep encouraging him. You know, I say, hey, why don't you come to church today? You know, I did tell him. I said, you know, if you don't feel comfortable or if you doubt about your faith or you feel like it's not quote unquote working for you anymore. I said, why don't you talk to the priest? He just doesn't want to take that step. And any words of advice?
Well, in one way, keep doing what you're doing. Keep praying. Mm-hmm. You know, be the Saint Monica for him. You know, while he's going through this, realize it is a process for some people, and it may work itself out. It is the danger with people is that marijuana is commonly referred to as a gateway drug,
right.
Where in and of itself it has a certain amount of harm it would do to an individual's life. But the real danger is that after a while that won't be enough and we'll want to ramp up to something else. To be honest, I'm not sure of the, you know, if I just brought him to church, he would see the way kind of a thing. The drug is filling a hole in him, a need in him right now that we don't know how else it could be filled. Certainly on an intellectual level, there's so much science out there of the harm that pot smoking actually does to the individual, the brain cells and their motivation, and just it's not the harmless drug that we once thought. But I would just, you know, continue to pray, continue to be supportive of them. It's sad to say, but it's not that different from society as a whole, where it's quite common out there and almost accepted in a lot of
neighborhoods. Yeah, society's trying to make
it
legal,
right?
Which makes it more difficult for you as a parent to say this is not good for you.
Right.
Right.
Is your son still living at home?
He still lives at home.
Is he working, going to school?
He finally got a job. We gently encouraged him to seek employment, and he did get a job. He's staying at the job. He's been there for like almost 6 months.
Okay.
They're hiring him full time. He started off part time. He's a very creative individual, so I don't know if this creativity thing has anything to do with it, but he sings beautifully. He plays guitar. He's a very sensitive guy. He loves his friends. You know, and I, what bothers me is he would go on retreats every year. We would take the kids to rallies and such, and he always had such a good rapport with all the deacons and the priests that were in his life, and it's just unbelievable. It's just so scary, and it hurts, you know, just to see him in this position.
And I think you said
I just feel like, you know, this is something he's got to go through, and I agree with you. But saying, when is it going to end? For a parent, it just seems like, you know,
it never is going
to end. You'll never see anything different. And sometimes I just need that encouragement, too, you know. Keep on praying. And it's good to hear you speak this way, though, because it gives me hope
in
the future for him.
And for yourself, there are certainly organizations out there to offer you some support. There's the Al-Anon. There's a Nar-Anon for family members of people with narcotics problems, or Al-Anon for those that are alcoholics. And that may be something to investigate for yourself, for your own peace of mind, because all these diseases are not individual. They are family diseases, and the family suffers, and the family needs to recover. So you have to take care of yourself and your spiritual condition, and so I would certainly investigate that. And also look at there's a common expression of the alcoholic is not a bad person trying to get good, but a sick person trying to get well. So if this does progress and, you know, to a problematic state, it's always really important for me to keep that in mind. These aren't bad people. My son didn't go bad. He's sick. He has an illness. He has this attraction, this need for the substance right now that, as you said, he may outgrow or it may progress, which really, you have to kind of just step back and wait and continue to always remain, an open receptacle for him for help advice. I'll certainly keep you in my prayers. And
absolutely.
Check out those groups. Check out Al-Anon.
Can I say one other thing?
Sure.
People at church, I was talking to them about him. They said, why isn't he in church anymore? And I was explaining, and they said, let's say a novena to St. Joseph, because my son likes to do woodworking and such, and he really would love to make furniture. So we did do a novena for him, about three of us, and I saw a subtle change in him. Things started to change a little bit. So, you know, you just made me think of that. Like, sometimes I feel like, oh, things aren't changing, but they actually are.
The power of prayer.
Don't give up.
Ways. Yep. That was really beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, the power of prayer. Yeah. Do not underestimate it. It is the most powerful force in the universe.
And we will be keeping you in prayer, Margie, and your son.
Thank
yeah, we'll
you
keep
so
you both
much.
In prayer.
God bless you all.
God bless you,
Margie. You're
all
not right. alone.
All right.
You're not alone.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Amen. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was great to hear, Margie, and it's unfortunately, as you said, it's a struggle that many people share, not just with alcohol, but other addictions. Each one is a little bit different, though, as I understand it. You know, they each have their own things. We only have a few minutes left. Let me turn just to the last bit, Deacon Dan, of your journey. So, you know, as your life has turned around, what drew you finally into the diaconate?
I've got 4 minutes to become a deacon here.
we'll
take the advanced course here. And it's very similar to the disease in some ways. It's progressive. The seed of faith was established in the early days of sobriety, and faith progressed. And I cooperated with that faith, was open to the grace, and continued to get involved in my faith, continued to get involved in the church. And it came to a point of saying, well, I was doing all this stuff. I can't do any more. So maybe it's not a matter of doing, maybe it's a matter of going deeper. Mm-hmm. And that was the first idea. Well, maybe it's something like the diaconate. But to be honest, the first time I saw a deacon, I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that there was some married guy up there giving a homily.
Right.
So my initial reaction was, I don't like that. So it took a while for me to first educate myself on what had been happening in the church and all the years I've been gone, what the diaconate was. And then this remarkable coincidence that maybe that call that I'd heard, you know, years ago of,
right.
I want to be, you know, this minister and the clergy, and I want to work with alcoholics. Suddenly became a reality, and that's what I have today.
And that's part of your ministry today, isn't it? Besides being the deacon of your parish, is administering to those with alcohol trouble.
Yeah, I'm still active in the recovery movement, and in the parish, I get the if anybody comes with a substance issue, I usually reach out and try to help them. So yeah, it's still part of my ministry.
As we are winding down, do you have any resources that you can just kind of like certain websites or
books
or anything that you just want to say, this is the moment to share with our listeners that might be helpful?
We live in an age of so much information out there. There's not one answer for it, just like there's not one answer for what may help in an alcoholic. If it's the family, I would say reach out to those organizations I just mentioned, as for Margie, say an Al-Anon or an R-Anon. Because the people need to take care of themselves.
Absolutely.
If it's the person themselves, you know, it's all the organizations for whatever, you know, their problem may be. Companies are very free with employee assistance programs today of getting help, and it's never been such a friendly climate for, you know, someone seeking help. So I would say you would just have to take that step and that you say, I need help.
And which one worked for you once again? The name of your program that you went to in
the rehab I went to was Father Martin's Ashley in Havre de Grace, Maryland. There are many
others,
good ones around.
But it's always good to
yeah. Or you can just walk off the street into a recovery meeting. You know, rehabs are not required, but yeah.
I'm sure they're going on every day throughout the community somewhere. Exactly. Somebody's having a meeting.
Exactly.
You know, I have a few seconds left here. Deacon Dan, would you just close us out with a little prayer here?
Oh, certainly. I want to keep in prayer, first of all, a young man at my daughter's high school. I don't have all the details, but I realize he was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and the school is reacting admirably. They're just unified in prayer, so I want to keep that young man in our prayers. I would pray for everybody that's listening that may have a problem of any type that fits into what we've been talking about, of an addiction, of whether you're a family member or, you know, whether you're the person with the addiction, that there is hope. That there is hope for you. And we lift them all up in prayer. And we pray for ourselves and that we've been given this ministry.
All right. Thank you very much to one and all for joining us. This is Deacon Dan Giblin.
Thank you
for listening to Deacon Dialogues. We hope you will join us each month at this time, the fourth Friday at 4 p.m., or for the encore the following Sunday at 2 p.m.